Good day and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. And today's food lit program is a part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And she's explained that I'm Jerry DeVecchio, so I don't think we have to repeat that. But it is really my pleasure to introduce our distinguished guest and my long-term friend, Patricia Wells. you have, she mentioned some things, but you have an amazing career in the culinary world. As a renowned author of Food Lover's Guide to Paris, which brought us together the first time, and Patricia Wells at Home in Provence, which is an amazing place, among many other books. She's been honored with the Versailles World Cookbook Award in 1999 for the best promotion of French cuisine. She was the first woman and only foreigner to have served as a restaurant critic for the French publication L'Express. She currently runs a popular cooking school in Paris and Provence. and we now have a culinary queen in our presence, and we're going to learn more about what she's about with her wonderful new book, which is right here, Salad as a Meal. Healthy main dish salads for every season. And that leads me into my first question for you. you've been the voice of France for many of us since your early books, which were, of course, Food Lover's Guide to Paris and also Food Lover's Guide to France. Now, amidst all this discovery of fabulous foods, when did your interest in eating well for health as well for pleasure begin to develop?
Well, I think it's always been there. I started running in 1968 in boys' basketball shoes before there was Nike or any of those places. And it's only been about the last 15 years or so that I really understood, as my coach used to say, that I had all the inspiration but not all the information. And so I just learned to rev things up a little bit. And in the course of all that, worked very hard at taking all the wonderful ingredients around me and learning how to balance them better, I would say. Say, for instance, in this book, we have a great number of salad dressings that are extremely light. I worked very hard to combine simple lighter ingredients in place of oil, although I have nothing against olive oil, but for a lighter dressing to substitute buttermilk or yogurt or light cream and combine that with lemon juice or lime juice and a bit of salt and lots of herbs. And so I've learned to kind of perk up the flavors without taking away any of the pleasures.
Well, in addition to all of this, I know you have a fabulous garden in Chanteduc, which is their country home in Vaison-le-Romaine, where we met as I was spending Septembers in Provence for a number of years. We were actually across the river neighbors. We could see each other's gardens.
In a distance.
So how is your interest in gardening, which is lovely, how has this inspired your new book, Salad as a Meal?
Well, I think we've had a garden there since we purchased the property in 1984. But each year we kind of add to it and get a little more complicated with things. We now grow about 40 different kinds of heirloom tomatoes, lots of zucchini, mostly for the blossoms because you can buy zucchini for nothing when it's in season. But I love to go out in the morning and pick either zucchini or pumpkin blossoms and do all sorts of fantastic things with those. We have lots of herbs. We have fruits on the property, a lot of figs. Some things do less well. The hornets like to get at the peaches and the Asian pears, so I have to kind of cool it with those. I have a garden rule that everything gets 3 years. And after 3 years, if it doesn't produce or I can't control it in an organic manner, then we pull it out.
So you are an organic follower.
Yes.
Now, in Salad as a Meal, you make use of many French inspirations, but you also include recipes such as American Cobb salad, Caesar salad, guacamole, and dressings with Thai flavors.
Right.
Now, I know you travel wide and far, but do you look for ideas wherever you go?
Absolutely. I look for ideas walking down the street. Every restaurant I go to, I pick up at least two or three ideas. Yesterday, for instance, I did a demonstration at Google, and the recipe called for pistachio oil, and the chef said I couldn't find any, so I made my own. I said, what? So what he did is he took pistachios, he toasted them, he poured warm oil, over them, and marinated that for 4 or 5 hours and strained out the pistachios. And it was the most fragrant, delicious oil. So now we can all make our own nut oils for very quick manner.
Well, I was going to ask you, how taking your own skills as a cook, how do you bring your own tastes and style to the recipes that you, well, you create, basically? You're
well,
not
I don't
really
create
copying.
All, I would say, you know, my inspiration comes sometimes from the market, sometimes from the garden, sometimes from restaurants. And sometimes it'll just be an idea. Other times it'll be a written recipe that a chef sends me. And I think, you know, I think I'm sure you're the same as a cook. You cook the foods you love to eat. Mm-hmm. And so for me, it's a lot of vegetables, a lot of lean protein, fish, shellfish. I tend to love raw fish and shellfish a lot. Sometimes people criticize this book for saying I have too many raw fish dishes, but... Hey, I'm the boss, so I'm. I
that's
the
right.
What
you're
I want.
The, you've got the pen in hand, or your
that's
computer
right.
in hand. Yes.
That's right.
Well, now, as I say, we associate you so firmly with French, but it seems to me you're going a bit international now.
Well, I guess I, as you said, as you asked, I do pick up ideas wherever I travel. We did a class in Vietnam a year ago, so I spent months really researching the Vietnamese cuisine and spent time there. And I think that today, all cuisines are influenced by Asian ingredients for sure. I am Italian in origin, so and I have done classes in Florence and Venice and Verona and Trattoria, travel extensively in Italy, so there's no reason to block that out. And as you mentioned, in Salad as a Meal, I have the fabulous, you know, some of the original salads as a meal, the Caesar salad, the Cobb salad, the French salads of Niçoise and the chef salad and so on. Those are the, you know, basically the original ideas for making a whole meal from a salad.
But each has your own touch.
Right, each, yes.
Yeah. We sort of touched on this, but the one thing about this book, it's full of wonderful illustrations. And tell us how the pictures were made and who your photographer was and how much your garden is part of it.
Absolutely. The photographer is Jeff Koch, who's a food photographer from Chicago, Illinois. And he and his wife and daughter came as students to our class several years ago. And he emailed me in advance and said, I'm a professional food photographer. Do you mind if I take pictures in the class, which everybody takes pictures? And I said, you can take all the pictures you want, but when it comes time for you to make that tarte tatin, put down your camera and pick up your whisk. And so we had a wonderful time and really got along well with them. And when it came time to decide on the photography for the book, which I was going to do, and then I decided, as my husband Walter's always saying, make it simple, make it easy on yourself. I said, okay, I'm going to make it easy on myself and not do the photography. And I called Jeff and said, would you be willing to do this? And so he photographed this book. He's photographed my next book, which comes out in November, which is called Simply Truffles, the mushroom, not the chocolate. And he's also will be doing my next book. So we've had a really great collaboration. And we did all the photographs in the book in a period of about 10 days. And we would start sometimes at 6 in the morning when the light was really wonderful. Everything was taken under natural light, 90% outdoors, except 10% of the time when the Mistral was blowing too hard, when we had to go up into my gym and create a little studio there. But it was a joy to do it. You know, don't feel sorry for me. We'd start at 6 in the morning, and we'd finish by 1, and then we'd sit down and eat all the salad.
Well, I'm sure all of you know what the Mistral is, but in case you have never been in France when it blows to the south, it comes from the north to the south.
Right.
And it makes your chimneys howl. I mean, you literally, you can hardly go. I mean,
right, you think the house is going to blow
yeah,
away.
Yeah, it just, we were across the river and it would sound like the little brown jug. now, I will intercede. I've been alluding to the fact that we have shared some of the countryside with Patricia and Walter. In 1989, we started going to a house in Provence, in Vaison-la-Romaine, and went there every September, which is, I have to say, one of the finest months in France, for many years. And Patricia and I used to bump into each other almost every Tuesday because we had market day in Vaison-la-Romaine, a very good market, too. Some are small, but it was very good. but I've noticed through the years that the food choices began to change considerably. Now, in the ingredients and salad as a meal, it also represents what was once a big, if not impossible, for a French cookbook. Now, tell us how markets and ingredients choices have changed in the years that you have lived in France. Now, does quinoa show up in the street market?
Absolutely.
Or fresh chilies? Now, but it didn't used to.
Leaves? I have those in my garden.
Yeah, okay. In fact, what is the health of the street market in France, or are they becoming farmers' markets?
Well, the market system in France, especially in Provence, has always been extremely strong. And we've lived in France for 32 years, and it's what I would say is the markets were always strong. They're just as strong. There's just a lot more choice. I mean, 20 years, 25 years ago, you got three kinds of tomatoes, basically. In fact, it's very funny because the variety, the Russian tomato, which are, you can get up, they can be 5 pounds, go up to be 5 pounds. And they started showing up at the farmer's market in Vaison, and I asked them, I said, why? Where did you get these from? And they said, oh, well, we always grew these for ourselves. We didn't think anybody else would want them. They thought they were weird varieties, you know, that the consumer would not buy. But certainly the varieties of tomatoes, potatoes, I mean, there used to be three, you know, there was a potato for boiling, a potato for roasting, and potato for making fries. And now you can get 20 or 30. In fact, in Paris, there's one guy who goes around to all the markets and he has 20 or 30 varieties of potatoes, and he's the potato man. And so I just think it's you know, back to a lot more heirloom varieties grown all over the country. And even whether in fruit and apples, well, you know our fig man. We have a crazy fig man in our neighborhood. And I think he has something like 80 or 90 varieties of figs. And you can go there in the fall and taste all of the figs and then decide which ones I want this and this and this. In fact, with my students, we once did, I think we tasted 30 varieties of figs and then had an all-fig lunch after that.
The siren blew my last thought. basically, I am curious, though. You know, we see here in California, in fact, across the United States, a number of young people pursuing agriculture from this perspective. Are the young people driving this change in France, or some of the old farmers dusting off their...
I think, I would say yes. I know even back when I was researching the Food Lover's Guide to France, I would be told that, you know, there are only two farmers left making this cheese. And then, whoosh, two young couples would come in and embellish and add to the number of people making those cheeses. So yes, definitely.
So, and are some of the, shall we say, foods of history also reappearing?
Such as foods of history.
Well, some of the cheeses that might, you know, so many times things are made by a person.
Right, right.
And when they're gone, that goes. But
I would say, you know, as I said, I mean, it would seem to be just as something was ready to die out, a young couple or young people would swoop in and take care of it. And I think the same is true definitely in the winemaking area. A lot of, I mean, even 25 years ago, winemakers made wine the way their daddy did, and they didn't ask questions. Now their sons have gone to schools in California, in Australia, in France, and they know a lot more about winemaking. In fact, one of the lines now is that they're no bad wines, they're just bad winemakers.
Well, I will say one thing about food trends is, you know, you all have the internet and you get a joke. And how fast a bad joke travels. Well, food ideas seem to travel just about that fast. Why do you think that's happening?
It blows my mind. Right now in Paris, there's a yuzu craze. And you cannot go into a restaurant and have a yuzu souffle. There's now yuzu butter, yuzu salt, yuzu zest, yuzu juice. You can buy all. And it's like it happened overnight. And I think, well, how does this chef know that that chef is using that ingredient? And I love it. I think it's fun. But boy, it sure moves like lightning.
Well, I know because in my early years in France, in Vaison, it was hard to find a fresh lime.
Right.
And now
right.
It's ouzu. And you all know what ouzu is. It's a very special little lime from Japan, which they are growing here. Now let's see. Now you are really a from scratch cook. I think I'd have to say that.
Right.
But in salad as a meal, you even cure your own capers. But a caper plant isn't all that available.
It is here.
Really? You see, yes. I know we grow it here because we did them in Sunset years
ago. That's right. You could have one
okay.
in your backyard.
So, but what's the alternate? It's a plant that grows rampant in San Francisco. You have an alternative for the caper.
Oh, nasturtium.
That's right.
Absolutely.
It grows everywhere.
Yeah, nasturtium buds.
Nasturtium buds. They grow all over the hillsides here. And are there other such simple solutions in your book for home cooks who want to go one step beyond?
Well, I have homemade cornichons. I've tried growing cornichons. I don't know if any of you have, but, you know, you pick two, and then you pick two more, and then you pick two more. It's sort of not real economical. So when I do find cornichons in the market, I buy everything I can find, and I make my cornichons. But also artichokes. You can, you know, make wonderful artichokes in a marinade that you can keep for pizzas and pastas and so on. My mother always canned and preserved a lot of ingredients. We have a recipe for spiced grapes that you can serve with your cheese course. And
did I see olives in here?
Cured olives. Yes.
Which you can also do in California because you can get olives in California. So there's a great deal of compatibility between the content of this book, although this is really written for an American market more than French.
Yes, absolutely.
And now you also have a wonderful set of pages for where to get ingredients.
Right. I have a whole list of the tools that I love to cook with. The ingredients, special ingredients. And it's, you know, granted we can find everything kind of in our backyard, but if we can't find it in our backyard today, there's always FedEx.
That's right. Because the internet, of course, you've made use of a lot.
Yes, absolutely.
That makes shopping for special ingredients a much simpler process.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Let's see. Now, I'm hoping you all have some questions, too, because I might run out. We might just digress and start having a good time. Now, tell us about the breads in your book that you've chosen to accompany your salads. I know you love to bake, and you have a wonderful stone oven. She has a kitchen, which is... I have the world's worst kitchen. She has the world's best kitchen.
That's not true.
But I'll ask you to describe your kitchen a little bit, too, after we get on with your breads, because your baking there.
Well, I love baking breads. I have a recipe for my sourdough bread that I bake regularly for my classes and for my students and guests. But I also love flatbreads. I have a quick pizza breads for making pizzas, but also we have a wonderful tomato and mustard tart in there that is great as a little side for a lot of salads, or flammekuchen, which is onions and bacon and a little bit of fromage blanc. And nice black peppercorns, flatbreads. I have a wonderful ham and cheese bread that I love to serve again with salads. Also a lot of soups, because I feel that, granted, the salad as a meal is wonderful, but if you think of soups as liquid salads, a lot of vegetables in the salads. I have peas, zucchini, tomatoes. My heirloom tomato soup, which I have for breakfast every morning in the summertime. And I just try to really have a good palette of a variety of salads.
Well, I was going to say, this book is really more than salad recipes. The title tells more. It says salads as a meal. But you have some soups. You already beat me to it. Sorbets of mustard, which I was intrigued with. Many dressings, of course. But you also recommend wine with salad. Tell how they all fit together.
Right. And one of the things that I'm very strict about, even though almost all the recommendations for wines are French, because that's what I tend to know best and have available. But every wine that is mentioned in the book can be purchased, is available in the United States. It's all imported into the States. So I try to make it easy on you.
Okay, we're going to indulge you in some of your questions. Now, why didn't I think of this? What San Francisco restaurants do you like?
Oh, well, I've been to Boulevard and Prospect so far. We are going to the new Quince's new Trattoria tomorrow, and the new Japanese restaurant tomorrow night. Obviously, and a lot of events. For instance, tonight we have an event at Left Bank, and they're cooking from the book, so I get to eat my own food as well.
The Left Bank here,
and the best meal was not in a restaurant, but at Jerry's house the other night, where she injured herself.
First time in my life a crab caught me.
Her crab got her. She did the most wonderful dinner of asparagus and crab and artichokes and some nice chablis.
Springtime.
Really lovely.
At home. Now, do you ever plan to publish a new edition of the two Food Lover's Guides that you have for Paris and France?
Well, I am updating the Food Lover's Guide to Paris, which was last updated in 1999, as an app, and it should be out in about a year. And a book will probably follow, but I don't know that for sure.
Now, Patricia, I know everybody else knows what an app is, but I'm not real sure what an app is. What is an app?
Well, it's an app, something you put on your phone.
An application, perhaps?
Yes. And the current concept is to have about 200 very selective addresses, restaurants, wine shops, chocolate, pastry, bread, specialty shops. And so you'll just be in Paris, and you just go, here I am, and up will come all the places in the neighborhood. Or you'll say, I only want dinners under 30 euros, and boom, up it'll come. So it's magic.
That's a lot of work.
Magic.
Now, I'm just going to intercede here that you are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Patricia Wells, author, food critic, and chef, who is discussing her latest book, Salad as a Meal, Healthy Main Dishes for Every Season. So, now there are lots more questions for you. Please discuss in more details your view of organic garden. Include your remarks, in your remarks, your view of mega farm organics.
Mega farm organics, you're talking about these huge, who's asked the question about?
Yes, like the large farm.
I can't really comment on that. I only know what I've read about, so I've not ever visited one, so I can't say. I'm just a little girl with a little garden, so I'm not qualified to answer that. But as I think I told you that I have the 3-year rule on gardening. Last year I had the most, and I'm sorry I didn't get a picture of it. One pest we have in the springtime when there's a lot of rain is snails. And so they were all over the garden, and so we put down some little organic pellets. And so let's say they were all here, and they carried all the pellets and built the Great Wall of China at the other end of the garden.
The snails did
that? The snails carried every pellet one by one, and they built this Great Wall of China. But I read something a few months later on insect behavior, and a lot of them just follow the leader, and the guy says, hey, come on, let's build this Great Wall of China. And they carried every pellet and built this wall. It made no sense, and it didn't kill them. But I think they probably they over-exercised, and maybe they...
Well, I would say it's probably better to give
them... It was so wild. When I saw that, I thought, wow.
Gosh, that's a struggle.
But we're fortunate in that we don't really have many garden pests, so we don't have to, do handstands to keep a very clean garden. We do have wild boar. And one year we did have to build a fence around it, around the garden, because the wild boar come in looking for the... looking for the worms. And we also have to be very careful about what we put in our compost bin. We can't put anything, obviously nothing cooked, only raw, only vegetables, and nothing with nuts in it or seeds. For instance, no pits, because that's what they like to go for. So I think if you have a compost, you have to kind of know in your region what you can and can't do.
You know, the wild boar, when we were your neighbors, I kept hearing this crunching in the night. And so finally, we had hazelnuts out in the garden. And so, like a complete idiot, I went out with a flashlight. You don't want to meet a boar with a flashlight. Barefooted. Okay, now, please discuss in more detail. Oh, I just asked you that question. We don't have to do that one anymore. Describe your perfect day in Paris. Food-centric, of course.
Oh, perfect day in Paris. Okay, I'd get up, go run in the Luxembourg Gardens, come back and have my breakfast of cottage cheese and heirloom tomatoes, work for a while, go out to lunch with my husband Walter and maybe some friends to our favorite cafe, the Croix Rouge. And I would have the recipe's in the book, of they do this tartine or open-faced sandwich on beautiful poilin bread with a tiny bit of mustard and very, very thinly sliced, very rare cooked beef.
I love that picture.
And some cornichons and a crummy little mush of salads and tomatoes. But, you have, and then a little glass of Brouilly. And then we'd probably work in the afternoon and then again with Walter go to one of our favorite bistros. How's that?
That's a good life. We may all follow you. Well, it's not, what are your favorite Paris restaurants today?
Okay, my favorite Paris restaurants, you can go onto my website, patriciawells.com. And click on, I think, Paris and then restaurants. And there's the list. It's the most up-to-date list of places I've been in the last 3 months. And it's very interesting, the trend in Paris restaurants today. When I moved to France in the 1980s, every restaurateur, the only way to really become known was to look for the stars, to work hard to get your first Michelin star, second, third. And that's what worked then. Today, even though all of those restaurants are fabulous and I love them and I go to them, The trend today is more towards young chefs going off into a very unusual arrondissement that we might not be visiting every other day and opening up a little 20 or 30 seat restaurant, very inexpensive, sometimes just one menu, and really good food. So that's the trend today, and that's a lot of the restaurants, Table de Eugene, Filou, those are kind of the restaurants that are really very popular today.
So the old three stars aren't the only things to follow.
That's right. They're still great, and I still follow them, but there's a much greater variety available.
Because, you know, one always used to think of Paris having very stable restaurants that went on for generations, but clearly this is different now.
Right.
Yeah. But the young chefs are popping up all over the place.
Exactly.
You've been a very fine advocate for many of them. Yeah. Now, what do you crave most from the U.S. when you were in France, food or beverage-wise?
What do I miss?
What do you crave most from the United States when you're in France?
Soft shell crab we don't get.
Yes.
I love that. There's not a lot that we don't have anymore. Cottage cheese used to be one of mine, but now we have that. We don't have Zinfandel, so when I come here, I like to drink Zinfandel. So we don't have that grape in France.
I must say, one suffers well in France.
That's a great quote.
Now, do you recommend putting lemon juice on your salads, then salt and pepper, so the salt and pepper attach to the lettuce or the salad, so the dressing doesn't wash the salt and pepper to the bottom of the salad bowl? This is a very technical
question. That's a very good question, yes. That's no problem. One of my favorite, though, is to just take the salad, just even use a spray, an olive oil spray, toss it really well, a tiny bit of vinegar or lemon juice. And one of the things I do is I always zest the lemon before I have it and juice it. And I make a lemon salt with it. So just zest your lemon or your lime or your grapefruit or your orange. Mm-hmm. Combine it 50-50 with a fine sea salt, either as is, or you can put it in a food mill and grind it very fine. Keep it in the refrigerator and use that as your seasoning. And one, it's a way to perk up any dish. And two, it's a way to reduce the amount of salt that you're consuming.
I'm so glad to hear it because, you know, sometimes lemon peel, my grandsons tell their friends, why, when they go to visit, your mother threw away the outside of the lemon. My grandmother always grates it. So, indeed, some of the simplest things do have the most lingering pleasure. Now, more details of where and when we can taste those 80 variety of figs.
Okay, he's in Vaison-la-Romaine. Pierre Baud, B-A-U-D, right.
Oh.
And in fact, he has written a cookbook, it's in French, on figs with Raoul Ryecroft from the Grand Prix.
It seemed to me I've read an article about that recently in something I was judging, yeah. Interesting place. Okay, what began your love affair with France, French and food, which I think this asks to be enlarged a little bit. What took you to France? What kept you in France? And why do the French love you so much?
Okay. What took us to France is Walter, my husband, and I were working at the New York Times. I was a food writer. He worked on the national desk as an editor, top editor. And he was offered a job to go to Paris to work as the managing editor of the International Herald Tribune. And since I was writing about food, it seemed like the natural thing to do for 2 years. So we moved to Paris, and at the end of 2 years, we looked at one another and said, well, I think if we stayed another year, our French would be better. And at the end of 3 years, we didn't look back anymore. And then I got the contract for the Food Lover's Guide to Paris, and as Walter likes to say, we went for his job and stayed for mine 32 years later. And what keeps us there is, we love it.
I love it. Now, the other thing, you were in Paris, and where we all love to go, and we all fantasize about Provence. I do. But how did you find Provence, then, as your second realm of enjoyment?
Well, it's very serendipitous. Our best friends who live in New York, we met them because we lived in the same building in New York. And they had rented our house in the 70s through an ad in Saturday Review or something like that. And when we moved to France in 1980, they decided to rent the house again. And one thing led to another. We tried to rent it. The woman said it wasn't for rent, it was for sale. And we ended up with this house, not knowing how we were going to use it, whether we'd go often or every now and then. And in many ways, it changed our lives because it helped, one, it helped me understand agriculture and growing food, the positive and negative, and the traumas and the troubles and the joys. And it also brought us closer to French culture, having a really large group of French friends from all over. And it just has enriched our life immensely.
Now, I do have to, I will personally describe to you Chantaduc. You go up a long, windy road. You're on the top of a hill. You're overlooking the valley of the Uvez River.
Uvez,
yes. A river which, the day after you came to our first meal at our house, proceeded to have the greatest flood in all centuries, in all time. At any rate, it was sort of exciting. Lots of people died. Ruins got washed all over the place. But anyway, but it has a wonderful vista. The garden is up there. And having seen the garden early and seeing the garden now, it's a place you want to be. And now you have cooking classes both in Paris and in Provence.
That's right.
And how do they differ, and how does one go?
Well, we started the classes in Provence in 1996, and it's been going gangbusters ever since. We do about 10 weeks a year with classic weeks in the summertime and a special black truffle week in January. And in Provence, we limit it to about 10 to 12 students. And throughout the week, we cook together, we visit vineyards. We do have our own wine, Clos Chantaduc, which Robert Parker gave a 92. He likes it. A little Cote de Rhone. And we go to the market, of course, and visit restaurants and really have a great time.
Well, as I recall, you were also very involved in sort of the artisanal resurrection. Did you start that, or was there not? There's an artisanal event of foods that I think you were very much involved in Provence.
A little bit. They have the Journée Gourmande. Is that what you're thinking about?
Yes,
now?
That's right, yeah.
And the problem is it's in November, and we're often in the United States at that time. But there is a huge artisanal growers, and we have good farmers who have wonderful poultry.
And breads.
And breads.
Drink, yeah.
Poultries, breads. Of course, fruits and vegetables.
Now, I date myself to when I was first there in 1989, there were a few places you could go to take cooking classes in Provence, but it seems to me there's been quite a proliferation
of interest. In fact, I think there are hundreds of schools,
yeah,
actually.
So.
And just to differentiate, and all of our classes are week-long. You can get all the information on the website, and also with the books today, we'll give you a list of the classes, a bookmark with the list of the classes for 2012. In Paris, I do 3 weeks every spring, and again, week-long. Everything is hands-on. And in Paris, it's limited to 7 people, and again, we go to the markets, go to a wonderful restaurant, have wine tastings, we do olive oil tastings, and we have a great time.
All right, here's another question. We asked that one. We hear that your husband, Walter, writes too. Well, we sort of learned that. But also, Walter has another extraordinary skill, and that is cabinet making.
Right.
So tell us about Walter's writing. And I actually, every morning, no morning could be then in Provence without a copy of the International Herald Tribune and a good cup of coffee.
Well, Walter has retired his journalistic cap, and he now has many, many, many jobs. He's been doing woodworking. He's going to start making wooden bowls for us. Maybe you'll see them maybe we'll have an artisanal website where you can purchase Walter's special wooden bowls. And he also works very closely with me on the schools, teaches class in knife sharpening and knife care. And he knows how to open a bottle of wine, too.
Knows how to empty it, too. That's right. You mentioned your what's coming up, your truffle book. Now, let's talk a little bit about truffles, because this is, I find, the world is very small, but never smaller than... when I first went to Provence, I'd heard that there was a truffle factory, somebody who put up truffles. And I looked for 2 or 3 years, and then I was at the Ritz-Carlton for a luncheon, and somebody who had been our guest in Provence this September before said, "Oh, look, Jerry, here's the truffle man." And it was Hervé Poron, who is Et Tatin. And Patricia and I got to know him together. As a matter of fact, in one magazine article, charming picture, they identified Hervé Poron
right.
as Walter.
Right.
But Hervé came, was a very, you know, I guess he was from someplace in Alsace maybe or somewhere. Mm-hmm. And he had come to San Francisco, or Sausalito. And when I met him, he said, "Oh, I used to be a hippie in Sausalito." And the wife that I knew then had a very Irish woman who was one of the first women bartenders at the No Name Bar in Sausalito. So here I trip over him again at the Ritz-Carlton in San Francisco. And then we find him right next door to us in Provence, and we all shared many meals together. But tell us how this whole truffle thing is evolving, because you might say simply truffles, but there's really nothing simple about a truffle.
Well, actually, there is, but it's well, we'll start with Hervé, and when we first moved to Provence, I realized that we had, well, we call it a truffle factory, but a factory is kind of the wrong word.
It's
just
not,
a little atelier.
At the building,
yes. And where he's a wholesaler for fresh truffles, which he ships all over the world. And then when they're finished with the fresh truffles, they preserve the truffles in many different ways. And so I got to know Hervé from the beginning. And we would work together every January. He invites all of the chefs around the world that use his product, restaurateurs, and we would have a big weekend. And we would always start the weekend with a truffle cocktail at my house, and Hervé would supply me with the truffles, gosh. And I would create 20 or 30 different appetizer dishes with truffles. And so after 20 years of doing that, I realized I had enough material for a book on truffles. But to backtrack, I remember when we first moved there and I found out there was a truffle factory. We also had a Saint Laurent factory. What more does a girl need in life?
That's right, downtown.
Remember when you'd go up the stairs
mill,
and
yes.
there was, you know, this, you
the
know,
mill,
Saint Laurent?
Yes. Yes. One, they did the knitting for them, yes.
Right.
Yes. Do we have more questions coming up? All right, well, let's take those. And now, of all the books that you've done, which I count 11 here, but
12 altogether,
12,
yeah.
Which 12 counts this one.
Right.
What was the most challenging and what was your most fun to work on?
Well, they're all fun to work on.
Okay.
I think the most challenging was Simply French, the book that I wrote with Joël Robuchon, because his recipes could be very complex. In fact, I remember one recipe, not in the first book that I did with him, but the second. It had 13 steps and it served 2 people. And it was a lobster recipe. And the way we worked is I would go into his restaurant in the morning and I would watch the chefs make the dish and I would take notes. And then it would come home and it would take me a day just to write the recipe before I even began working on it. So that was probably the most challenging and in many ways the most rewarding because it was a great experience. And to this day, I'm still very close to Robuchon and he's been very generous to me. I don't know which was, you know, I think, well, certainly Food Lover's Guide to France was also probably the most difficult and the most challenging in terms of time, effort, research. But again, super rewarding.
But also the Food Lover's Guides really require a lot of updating, so you
yes.
really spend a lot
yes.
of time on that.
Yes. It's a little bit easier today with the
is
the modern world.
Yes.
But
now, you can find things on the internet. Like, you know, if I want to find out, I come to the Commonwealth Club, I just type it in, it tells me where it is.
Right.
Is that helping you in France as well?
Yes, yeah. Yes, yes.
I suppose you have to speak French to do that.
Well, no, you don't.
All right.
You don't even have to type French.
Okay, let's see. Well, this comes right back to Joel. I think one of your best books was with Joel Robuchon, Comment on How Working with Joel and His Cooking Techniques. I think we sort of touched on that, but he's a very young man. We met him at your house, I remember.
Well, he's mid-60s, I'd say. Very young, yes.
Well, of course, that was a long time ago. He used to be young, just like most of us. Okay. Lettuce is the backbone of a salad, and I've never eaten lettuce anywhere that's as good as the lettuce in France. what makes them so good, or what makes it so good, soil or climate? Because there are lots of kinds of lettuce.
Well, I think probably, yes, I think probably soil and climate, certainly the soil and the varieties of the lettuce. But I've had some pretty good salads here, too. You know slouch here in San Francisco.
Well, certainly they've begun to grow salads, so they have more flavor.
Yes, yes.
And you can get, you know, it goes right back to variety as well as growing condition. And I know Renee Shepherd.
And freshness.
Freshness. Oh, freshness is everything. How does Joe Robuchon make his potatoes puree?
Oh, half butter, half potatoes.
I suspected as much.
And, you know, I don't think they still do, but they used to actually put it through a tammy, you know, to a
fine mesh
sieve.
Oh.
And I remember once, because, you know, almost every recipe was like, you know, strain again. And I once said to him, I said, Joel, does it really matter if we strain it five times? He said, there's no one step that matters, but it's all the little steps put together that make the big difference. And it's true.
And, you know, I do, that's one reason I like to eat someplace like Joel Robuchon's, because I want somebody else to do the work.
Right. I agree.
And he certainly does put an effort, as do many of those dishes. Again, going back to your shopping list, how did you, for the American market, how, living in France, how were you, how did you become so knowledgeable of these places here that we can make use of?
Just by paying attention. I mean, I'm very careful in if there's an ingredient, whether it's that might not be available to everyone, like squab and certain duck breasts, things that you might not always find in your local supermarket, I always look for a good source, and all of my food friends will, you know, suggest places on the West Coast or the East Coast or the Midwest that supply those ingredients. And then on my website, I also have an Amazon store of products, both of equipment, kitchen equipment, and what we used to call gourmet products. Like kaffir lime leaves and things that you might not find in your everyday stores.
Just an aside question, but I noticed Bridge out of New York. Are they moved out of New York on 30?
Yes, I
think
moved out. Yes.
God, that was the most wonderful cook store in New York. But they do still exist, and you will find their website here. See, I would love to improve my cooking skills. Sadly, cannot travel to France. Can I become a better cook if I were to concentrate on one cuisine? Which one would teach me the most?
Well, rather than concentrating on one cuisine, what I would say is sit down and make a list of the 10 things you most like to eat. Can't all be tarte tatin or pastries. And start with number one and make it over and over and over again. Pretend that you're a pianist rehearsing and perfecting a piece of music. And once you've perfected recipe number one, go on to number two. And then when you have 10 perfected, make another list of 10 and just work that way. I wouldn't limit myself to any single cuisine, but start with things that you love to eat yourself.
And also explore your own marketplace.
Exactly.
Nothing inspires dinner more than being hungry and going to the market. Well, what do you think of our San Francisco Ferry Building?
Oh, I love it. I've been there since, I think, the first year that it opened.
Yeah.
And the market's great, and the shops are wonderful. It's inspiring.
Yes, I have to say, it's one of our best gifts to our city, to ourselves. Tell us about some of the recipes in your book. How do they vary in complexity?
Really, there's no recipe in the book that's really super complex. In fact, I did a lunch for a group of friends the other day, just before I left, and I had 6 different salads, you know, small portions for everyone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they really go together very quickly. And in many of the recipes, you can make it easy on yourself by, rather than poaching your chicken breast, you can buy a roast chicken and cut that up into mm-hmm. cube up the chicken. There are lots of dishes that are you just have to toss together. I once, my agent, who is not a great cook, her husband does all the cooking, and she once said to me, "Oh, Patricia, I made your chicken salad the other day." And I said, "You don't cook." She says, "Well, I do, but I don't do heat."
I love that.
There are a lot of recipes here that don't require heat.
That's right. That's, you know, it's like for children, you know, no cooking.
Yeah. Right, right.
No cooking. All right, we have a question about salt, which, of course, is not quite a broad topic. It does. Salt. What regional French salt do you favor? And how many salts do you have in your pantry besides your lemon salt?
Well, I'm sort of a salt freak in that sense. I mean, I love to play with all the different salts that are on the market today. But if I was limited to one salt, I would use the sel gris from the Garonne in Brittany. I find it has a little more flavor than the salt that we find from the Mediterranean in the south.
Is that evaporated or mined salt?
It's an evaporated salt.
Yeah.
It's not a mined salt.
Yeah.
And but then now there are, I mean, I like to make my own flavored salts. I don't usually like to buy those, and I mix them with this black pepper. It's also fun to experiment, like with the black salt from Hawaii. It's fabulous. Just
and that red salt.
Put on and the red salt.
Yeah.
Those are all kind of, you know, extras. I don't think they're essentials in the kitchen, but fun to play with.
But it is amazing. There is a place in the farmer's market, a ferry building, that does have rows and rows and rows of salts. You can certainly spend a lot of money on a box of salt. We haven't described your kitchen. We alluded to it. How could I let that slide by? Tell us about your kitchen where salad as a meal was born.
Well, when we designed the kitchen, which was finished in 92, I did not know I was going to be doing cooking classes. And it turns out it's quite perfect for the classes. It's fairly large. It has a big, large island in the center. And then around the sides, I have a La Cornue stove with 6 burners and 2 ovens.
Blue?
No.
Wasn't
it black?
Is it black?
It's black. That's okay.
Well, I was just feeling good.
That's all right. The kitchen is kind of ochre-colored. And when I do a kitchen, I always try to make sure there's an island in the kitchen because even if you're cooking by yourself, it gives you a lot of space to work on. Or if you want to do a buffet, it's nice to set up all of your dishes right there. I try to have like an open, a glass cabinet. There was a little beeping. I try to have a glass cabinet so that if your guests or friends are cooking with you, they don't have to say, where's this, where's that. I try to have a lot of utensils out and open, especially for my students, so they're not screaming, where's the whisk? And I try to give them a walkthrough of what's all there.
Now, you had 2 sets of sinks, but they were interesting sinks.
Yes.
They weren't just sinks.
Right. We have a gigantic, it's over a yard long, double sink of marble, very old, and then another one that's of sandstone.
And it's shallower, as I recall.
Fairly shallow, yes. And I love those because it's one student once said, oh, these are really great because you can't see when they're dirty. But I love old things.
Now, the stone oven you bake in, is that in the outside garden, right in the little outside garden, or
yes,
is it in the,
we,
I've forgotten.
Right, we
kitchen.
Have a wood oven that we built. And when I first built it, I was our mason. I didn't build it. We asked our mason, have you ever built a bread oven? And he said, yes, I just built one for my uncle. So we went out and looked at that, and then he built the oven. And this was the early 80s, before anybody had a pizza oven. There was no instruction on how to use it. And so it was just by hook and by crook of, experimenting. And I remember the first time I heated it up, and I put a thermometer in there because I thought, well, I want to see how hot it gets. And it didn't seem like the thermometer was moving. Well, I started to grab it, and the thermometer had gone all the way around. It was like, beyond the highest temperature. But over the years, I've learned how to use it very well. And it's like a magical oven. If you heat it heat it right, it takes whatever you put in there and doesn't burn it. It's fabulous.
And do you have do you have a wood door on it or a stone door?
No, it's a sandstone door.
Yes.
That, in fact, was there in the olden days in our farmhouse, there was a bread oven in the kitchen, in the old kitchen, which was taken out, but they kept the door. And so we used that as a door for our wood oven.
Now, your kitchen, was that originally the kitchen? Because
your
cottage, it was sort of a cottage on many levels, as I recall.
Right. And it's very funny because the room that was the kitchen when we bought the house had a window about this big overlooking the parking lot. And the room next door, which was used sort of like what we would call a family room, had this magnificent window overlooking the sunset. And so I used to walk to that window and say, someday I'm going to peel carrots at this window. So we flip-flopped the rooms and turned the family room, the kitchen, into the family room.
Okay.
And vice versa. And it has the greatest view of the sunset.
And where they are, they not only catch the sunrise, they do catch the sunset out of the kitchen window. The color, you cannot imagine how beautiful Provence summer skies can be.
Oh. Come back, Terry, come back.
I keep thinking, I do think about it. Share more about your writings today.
Well, the next book after Truffles is, well, it'll be either the application of the Food Lover's Guide to Paris, and also at the same time I'm working on a book that is at home with Patricia Wells in Paris and Provence, and it will be a lot of collection of advice that I give to students from the cooking school, things that students ask, a lot of Q&A, more technique than I have in the other mm-hmm. books, and then the same style of recipes, but some inspired specifically by Provence and others inspired specifically by Paris.
Well, you know, thinking back to lovely evenings with dinner at your house, you were doing very interesting things with very traditional dishes. I remember she did potatoes roasted in hay and a clay casserole, and it really, you know, it did make a difference.
It does.
And how did you, again, the world moves fast, but some of these old ideas are sliding away, and you kept some of those traditions.
Well,
it's
amazing. I think the first time I ever tasted that was a chef who, traditionally his grandmother had cooked a whole ham in hay, which gives it herbaceous. Thank you.
Yes, Walter. Sweetly herbaceous.
Sweetly herbaceous. Thanks. I got my little
that word.
A sweetly herbaceous flavor. I was going to say earthy, but that doesn't work. But it also adds humidity. It mm-hmm. almost works like a clay cooker. Mm-hmm. And so I always was curious about that. And many years ago when the olive oils from the Le Beau area got their Appellation d'Origine Contrôlée, the AOC, a big award, badge of quality from the French government, the hay from the Foin de Crau, C-R-A-U, is an area near Arles, where they raise all of the hay that if you have a racehorse, do all of you have racehorses? You want your racehorse to be given that foin de croix. It's like nothing else in the world, you know. And so what they did as we left was a gift of the olive oil packed in the hay, and so I saved that hay for years and roasted my potatoes in it.
I'm sure your boar would like it. No, in the
oh yeah, the boar. I don't know.
No, they don't. They like hazelnuts.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned the fact that you don't have very many adversarial creatures in your garden outside of wild boars and what have you, but you do have a very special yellow jacket, about four times natural size. What the goupé? What did they call it? You have yellow jackets, and then you have this thing that is this big and it looks like a dive bomber. We used to get them in our house. What are they called? T-A-O-N. You mean you don't get them?
Oh, yes. Do we?
Yes.
Oh.
We had one nested in the rafter in the dining room light, and they would come out at night. Now, they were huge. Are they dangerous, Walter?
Very. You can kill a horse.
Oh.
Seriously?
I mean, if you can imagine a yellow jacket that big, where you can count the stripes when it's flying by.
And we do get scorpions, but...
Oh, yes, we do. Yes,
scorpions.
I found those.
Scorpions.
I used to find those in the bathroom.
But they're kind of harmless.
Well, as my grandson says, if they're little, watch out. If they're big, you're okay. So ours were kind of little. Well, other than what would ever bring you back to the United States? What possibly could ever make you change?
Well, I have to say, Walter and I, several years ago, made the decision to spend several months a year in California, specifically San Francisco. And we've gotten as far as making the decision. But we haven't acted on it yet. But we will.
You mean you might be my neighbors next
Absolutely.
September?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. No, I have to say, we were discussing the other night at dinner. San Francisco is uniquely gifted in size and resources and geographic and people.
And weather today.
And weather. Oh, today it's lovely. So
I think we need to...
I think, yes, somebody said they were going to beep us when it was time to quit. But, Patricia, I really want you to add anything you feel we've missed. And if there are any more questions, speak up quickly. Oh, is that what that's all about? It says 9, but that one says 2. Oh.
Oh.
All right. I'm going to turn it over to you to share why you enjoy the business of writing about food and cooking and living in France and coming to San Francisco. So, you know, tell us a little more.
Well, I think I'm very fortunate in that every angle of my career or careers kind of meshes and fits together, because if I was only writing cookbooks, it would be like writing in a vacuum. And if I was only teaching, I don't know where I would get all the new materials that I really need to keep changing recipes and upgrading and staying current. And so with the cookbooks and the classes, it's a perfect mesh and mix of always coming up with something new and then also publishing. So and giving my students new ideas and inspiration.
And also you do keep up with the world. I follow her trails in Australia, here, there, and yon, yes. And
Vietnam.
You spend a lot of time in Asia,
right?
India.
Right.
So, are there any other questions?
I think we should.
Well, that
talk cookbooks. And
talk books, yes. Now let's tell us about. Oh, that's right. I was supposed to tell you something here at the end. We got so interested. All right. Now the book will be on sale in the lobby.
Right, we're going to.
Yes, Salad is a Meal, a healthy main dishes for every season. And I think you will be quite delighted with the variety of what, or the way she's used salad to mean many more things than just a bowl of lettuce. Not that there's anything with just a bowl of lettuce, but it can be quite a creative experience as well. Other questions?
What about TV?
Oh, yes, why don't we see you on TV? It's a lot of work.
We might. It's not written out yet.
Okay. So you haven't decided this is nothing you want to do.
No, no.
You have not decided this is not something you want to do. That's what
do
I'm
not
trying
want
to
say. To do. That's right. Okay.
That brings Jacques here every year. And but if you were to teach, if you were to do television, would you, for an American audience, would you like to enlighten them about French,
well,
or
I think
the world, or
if
health,
I did
or?
A show, I would want to do it in France, because I think it's much, you know, to see me standing in a studio doesn't really.
And you have to be in Chantilly.
And I think it would have to be done in Provence and Paris.
Paris, yeah.
And like, do start with a series of like 4 shows and.
So eating is still alive and well in France.
Absolutely.
Cooking is alive and well in France, and dining is alive and well in France. Now I'm looking at 1 o'clock, but oh my goodness. Well, we have time to play a little bit. You have questions?
Okay, all right. Well, listen, thank you all for coming. This has been great. This is my second visit here, I think. And I hope there'll be a third coming up really soon. Great.
Yes.
Thank you.
There's another, please.